views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Get ready for a game changer. Sarah Westall is bringing you Business Game Changers Radio. Mondays at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, Sarah will bring you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Now here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and you're listening to Conscious Business Radio on the Transformation Talk Radio Network. I had an amazing response from my aging interview that I did with Bill Andrews a little over a month ago, and I had many people go to my website from all over the world and download this podcast. And I thought, you know, I should really do a follow-up on that. And one thing I thought about is Bill Andrews was talking about Aubrey de Grey and the fact that he is considered by most of the people in the aging field to be the foremost expert on doing the research and scientists in the area. And I thought, you know, I'm going to set up an interview with him. And he's interesting because he has a different take on the science behind curing aging. He thinks telomeres might be an important part, but he knows it's not the full story and that there's many other aspects that we need to solve in order to cure aging. And so what he's done is he broke it up into 7 different areas that needs to be solved. And his company, of which he is, I believe, the founder and also the chief scientist of it, is looking at each area individually and figuring out how to solve each one. And they are really far down that path. And so this is a really interesting conversation with him today. And now I want to welcome Aubrey de Grey to the program.
Hi, Aubrey. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I have all sorts of questions for you. I've been told that you are the foremost expert in aging in the world, which is a pretty big honor coming from different, you know, your colleagues. What motivated you to get into this field?
I had a rather unusual motivation for getting into this field. It was simply that I discovered, to my absolute horror, 20 or so years ago, that hardly anybody else was in it. And furthermore, that the people who were in it, who were working on the biology of aging, were not really doing so with a primary goal of doing something about it. They were a bit like, you know, seismologists. They understood that the thing they were studying is bad for you, but they didn't really have very much of an aspiration to actually stop it from happening.
Well, why do you think that is?
Well, I understood that pretty well, quite quickly, in fact. The reason why people were in that frame of mind back then was because they had decided that, number one, it was hopeless. There was really no foreseeable prospect of actually substantially postponing the ill health of old age. And number two, it was viewed as hopeless by the rest of society, to the extent that the rest of society considered it to be actually dumb to be thinking in those terms.
The social pressure.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, ultimately, like any scientist, people who were studying the biology of aging need to get funded. They need to actually appeal to the government and other public sources to supply money for their research. And they knew that it would be prejudicial to getting that money if they claimed to be working on something that the public, and therefore the elected representatives of the public, viewed as science fiction.
Well, do you think people could live forever?
So let's be perfectly clear here. I don't work on longevity, let alone immortality. I work on health. I am interested in stopping people from getting sick. The only real difference between what I do and what any other medical researcher does is that I and the foundation, Science Research Foundation, which has been created around my work, are pursuing a particular approach to stopping people from getting sick that has the potential to really, really stop it, to keep people at the same level of physical and mental function that is typical of young adults. And if we can achieve that, there will be a very big side effect in terms of longevity. It means that people will have a much smaller risk of dying in any given year, and therefore, on average, they will live a great deal longer than they currently do. All medicine has that same side effect. It's the side effect of not being sick, because ultimately the main thing people die of is being sick. It's just the magnitude of the side effect that sets us apart.
And living in a way that makes you feel good.
Living in a way that is good. Not just feeling, but looking and functioning just like a young adult. In other words, how you actually are, your molecular and cellular structure and composition, and therefore your function, will be the same as a young adult.
Well, do you think that focus is important for solving disease in the first place?
Certainly it's critical for solving the diseases of old age. The over-pessimism that people have about the ability that we might have in the foreseeable future to bring aging under comprehensive medical control is the flip side of a ridiculous over-optimism that people have with regard to what they think of as the prospect of curing the diseases of old age, things like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease and cancer and atherosclerosis and osteoporosis and all those things. Those things are not in any way biologically distinct from what people think of as aging itself. All of those things, whether the things we call diseases or the things that we don't call diseases, are aspects of, well, they're side effects of being alive in the first place. They are the consequences, the late stage consequences of the accumulation of damage that the body does to itself as a side effect of its normal function, starting from even before we're born. It's just that those side effects are essentially harmless until they have accumulated to a certain point, because the body is set up to tolerate a certain amount of that damage. But eventually there's too much damage and the body goes downhill.
So it's basically your body kind of falls apart over time.
Falls apart is probably a good term, yes. Essentially, various types of damage occur. Some of that damage consists of loss of stuff, loss of cells especially, cells dying and not being automatically replaced by the division of other cells. Most of the damage consists of various types of accumulation of garbage, you know, molecular waste products that accumulate both inside cells and outside.
So that's often called toxins.
Well, you could say that, but I mean, it wouldn't be toxins in the sense of things that we ingest, things that come from the outside of the body. These are toxins that the body creates automatically as an intrinsic consequence of things that we have to do that are non-negotiable, like breathing, right? That's how you need to think about it. And okay. It's also at cellular level. We have cells that have got into a state where they're no longer useful, and yet they don't die when they ought to. Or we've got cells that divide when they shouldn't be. That's, of course, the definition of cancer, more or less. So there's various different types of damage, but they're all easily definable, they're all well characterized, and all we need to do is figure out how to repair them periodically, and we'll be fine.
Well, how far are you at doing that? So that's your focus, is figuring out how to repair that. How is there more focus that you take, or is that your main focus?
That is our exclusive focus. In fact, it's slightly narrower than that, because some of the types of damage that I'm talking about are being pursued very effectively and energetically by other people. In particular, the loss of cells. The essential fix for that is replacing the cells using stem cells. And, of course, many, many people are working on that. It's a really burgeoning big field. So we do almost nothing in the stem cell area, simply because our contribution would be a drop in the ocean. We focus much more on the more neglected areas which people have not really got into elsewhere, either because they think they're too difficult or they don't understand the importance of them or whatever.
And what would those be?
Oh, there's quite a few. Where shall I start? Well, here's one. Arteriosclerosis. So the arteries undergo a variety of different types of damage. One of them is the accumulation of fatty deposits in the walls. Another is stiffening, just loss of elasticity. We work on both of those things. Accumulation of fatty deposits, which is called atherosclerosis, is something that we have recently spun out, actually. We've essentially transferred our work there to a startup company, which is taking it forward. But that's basically because we have made substantial progress in figuring out how to fix the problem, essentially by using bacterial enzymes to break down the stuff that the body cannot naturally break down on its own. Arteriosclerosis, the stiffening of the arteries, is an even more difficult problem. And there we are trying to identify compounds which can restore elasticity, essentially by breaking chemical linkages, chemical bonds that spontaneously accumulate within what's called the extracellular matrix, this kind of lattice of proteins that holds our body together and gives these various tissues the elasticity that they need in order to do their job. And that's at a pretty early stage. We're making great progress, but it's still at a point where most people, even in academia, would regard it as too difficult a problem for their short-term needs, namely the need to get promoted or to get tenure or to get their next grant application funded.
Well, is there anything, because this is pretty complicated, right? Is there anything that people can do to keep aging from occurring that is just a normal person can do?
Oh, yes. They can give us money.
But I mean, I know you are.
I knew you weren't going to like that answer. But it's a serious
no,
answer.
No, it's just, that's what everybody I interview needs money. And that's fine. My show's called Business.
No, let me be
clear.
Hold on
a second. My show's called Business Game Changers. So my show are bringing on a lot of people that are doing great stuff that is on the edge of things, right? And all those people are changing the game and making things occur. And so a lot of them are out there at the forefront needing money to keep, you know, blazing trails. But anyways, keep going.
I knew all that. But I would submit that I have a better case for my answer than most people do. Because the fact is that at the moment, there is nothing that most people can do to extend their healthy lifespan, and therefore their total lifespan, by even a little bit, even a couple of years. The reason there isn't is because we can look at what we have today. We can see that different countries with different diets and different social structures to support the elderly and different genetics, they only live very slightly differently. You know, the USA, people laugh at the USA a lot because you spend so much more than most countries on medical care, and yet if you look at the league table of longevity, you're down in the 40s, about 45 or something like that. But if you look at the actual numbers, you're only 4 years shorter lived than Japan, which is the number one country. So it's really, you know, pretty obvious that there's nothing we can do. Therefore, the only thing that's possible is to accelerate, to hasten the development of therapies that don't yet exist, which, of course, is what we're doing.
But there is something we can do with inside. Because the amount we can live now is quite a bit more than we lived 100 years ago, for example.
No, it isn't. No,
it isn't? Why would you say that isn't?
The only way in which you can say that it is if you look at the life expectancy at birth.
You are listening to Business Game Changers, and we need to take a short station break.
Do you want the freedom to spend more time with your loved ones? Travel the world? Live spontaneously? Get ready, because the Chip Justice Show is here. Hosts Dr. Pat Basile and Chip Justice can help you build meaningful success while embracing life. Living a life you love is the end game in this new, inspirational, and empowering show. Positive changes for a life you'll love. Tune in every month on TransformationTalkRadio.com and visit PositiveChangeInstitute.co for more information.
Holistic Medical Center is where you find it all, a healthy space with doctors who care, see, and listen to the whole you. During the month of October, Dr. Darvish and the Holistic Medical Team are promoting Breast Cancer Awareness Month with 25% off breast thermography. Safe, painless, radiation-free, and accurate. Purchase your breast thermography screening for 25% off now until October 31st to receive this special. Visit drdarvish.com or call 425-451-0404.
And we are back. This is Sarah Westall with Business Game Changers, and we're talking to Aubrey de Grey.
In other words, if you factor in the enormous proportion of people 100 years ago who would die in infancy or in childbirth or whatever as a result of infections, we have totally, as good as totally, eliminated that kind of death in the industrialized world.
So you would say that virtually all of that percentage came from keeping babies from dying and children from dying at a young age?
Certainly the large majority. We have made some much more modest progress in the past 50 or 60 years following the essential defeat of infant mortality. And that progress has been as a result of people having a lower probability of death in old age. But even that doesn't really translate into any particular reason for optimism for the near future, because that comes from what are called cohort effects. In other words, changes that happen to people early in life and that help them throughout their life. The biggest one of all is infant nutrition, even prenatal nutrition. People who were born 70 years ago got much better prenatal nutrition on average in the industrialized world than people who were born 100 years ago or 120 years ago. And therefore, those people who were born more recently have lived their entire lives being biologically younger than people, than their parents' generation, for example. So that is the main reason, according, as well as things like, you know, reduction in the incidence of smoking and obvious things like that. But mainly it's that. So it's not, that's reaching diminishing returns, exactly the same way that the defeat of infant mortality from infections has already reached diminishing returns. We are not going to help people who are in their 50s or 40s or 30s today to live longer by pursuing the same methods that were pursued in the past, because they've already been done.
Well, how do you see the function of telomeres? You know that I interviewed Bob Andrews, who I think you guys Bill Andrews, I'm sorry. And I know you guys are good friends with each other. He's working on telomeres, and he's very close to solving that problem. And if anybody listening haven't heard this show, they should go back and listen to that show. It's really fascinating. But he believes that that's a foundation for extending life. And what do you believe?
Bill and I are actually much more closely aligned than most people understand. Bill and I both appreciate that telomeres have a double-edged role in aging. On the one hand, if telomeres get too short in cells that need to divide a lot in order to keep us alive, then the cells will not divide a lot and there will be problems. But he and I also appreciate that if telomeres get too long in cells that we don't want to divide, specifically in cancer, then we've got a different problem, but it's just as life-threatening a problem. So really the only difference between Bill and myself in this is that we have slightly different intuitions with regard to which of those problems is more serious. And that has led us to pursue different approaches to doing something about it. Bill is interested in stimulating telomerase and thereby increasing telomere length. And he and I agree that that will have some beneficial effects, especially in the immune system. However, he and I also agree that it has a risk, which I would say is larger than he would say, of allowing more cancers to develop to a life-threatening level. So our approach that we're pursuing at Sense Research Foundation is to do the opposite, to inhibit the activity of telomerase as an anti-cancer therapy, we know that by doing so, we will create problems for the very same rapidly dividing cells that Bill is trying to help. But we think that it's worth it because those problems can be addressed using stem cell therapy as an adjunct to the anti-telomerase therapy. But the key thing, the most important thing that Bill and I agree on is that we don't know which way it's going to go, and therefore that it's critical that both directions, both themes of research should be pursued so that whichever one is correct will actually be done in time for as many people as possible.
So in theory, with stem cell research, you could essentially change out your whole body.
Well, in principle, we could use stem cells to regenerate and rejuvenate essentially any tissue in the body. That's certainly
even
true.
A brain. However,
even the brain. However, there are complications in all of those tissues with regard to getting the cells to the right place and making sure that the cells are the right cells. Even in really simple cases like Parkinson's disease, this has proven to be a pretty challenging issue. So stem cell therapy for Parkinson's disease was understood even 20 years ago to be the holy grail, to be basically the way to fix fix Parkinson's disease. And it was tried, and it only occasionally worked, basically because we didn't know how to ensure that the cells we were transplanting into the patient were the right type of cell. And there are similar complications with stem cells in other tissues, many of which are even more complicated because the cells need to migrate appropriately once you've injected them. That's why stem cell research is such a huge field. There's an awful lot that we still have to learn. But another thing I need to emphasize is that stem cells will not fix all of aging. There are problems outside of cells. I mentioned arteriosclerosis earlier, the stiffening, the loss of elasticity of the artery wall. That will not be fixed with stem cells. Similarly, there are aspects of Alzheimer's, aspects of other age-related diseases that involve molecular waste products accumulating outside cells. You know, they're not going to be fixed by stem cells either. By and large, waste products accumulating inside cells. Garbage, you know, molecular garbage is also not going to be fixed.
How do you get rid of garbage?
Exactly. So in sense, we have seven different approaches to fixing damage, and only one of them is stem cell therapy. The others are very different. For molecular garbage inside the cell, we actually are looking at other species, especially bacteria that we find in the environment. Turns out that bacteria are ridiculously versatile, and it's possible to find bacteria that can break down the various types of garbage that we accumulate. They don't do that in order to live longer, of course. They do it for other reasons, like to digest the material and live off it. But we can still co-opt that evolutionary creativity by introducing those genes into our own human cells. And a couple of years ago, we succeeded in doing that, only in cell culture so far, but still we did it. In respect of the major type of garbage that causes atherosclerosis, fatty deposits in the artery, which is, of course, the number one killer in the Western world. It's the cause of heart attacks and strokes. So this is an approach that's very, very promising.
That's a big deal. I mean, you can solve
Don't
that. That's huge. Yes.
It's huge. That's right. And more recently, we've had similar success in our approach to combating molecular garbage outside the cell, which we view as a separate category. The group that we're funding in Texas have been able to identify a special type of antibody that is proteolytic. In other words, it actually doesn't just bind to the material that it's cognate for, it actually chops it up and gets rid of the amyloid, the material that's accumulating. That group had already had some success in that regard with respect to Alzheimer's disease, and we funded them to do the same thing in respect of the type of molecular garbage that accumulates in the heart, which seems to be extremely important very late in life, at the age of 100 or more, for cause of death.
So do you believe that you're close on any of these issues, that you can really make a difference?
Oh, yeah. We're getting closer with all of them. We're making great progress. I think we're still, you know, the most difficult ones may still be 15, 20 years away from real clinical application. But many of them are more like 5 years away. So, yeah, we're making fantastic progress. However, I really want to emphasize what I said earlier on about the money. I would emphasize at this point that I would say at this point that we are probably going three times more slowly than we could. We could go three times faster if we just had $50 million a year to spend rather than the paltry $5 million that we have at the moment. And that's one hell of a lot of lives that would be saved.
Well, especially with heart attacks, and you're working on some of these therapies would solve some of the biggest problems that we have.
You're so right.
Well, now the question I have is, let's say somebody, you start getting some of these therapies out there. Is it really complicated? I mean, is there seven different things you have to do on somebody?
Yes, it is complicated. In fact, there are more than seven. When I say seven things, I'm only talking about seven categories, seven types of repair that need to be done. Within each category, at least within many of the categories, one will need to do several similar things, different in detail, but similar in general, addressing different tissues. So lots and lots of different things are going to need to be done to the same person at the same time. And we totally appreciate that will be a big departure from the way that medicine is done today, where they try to keep things simple. The other big departure, of course, is that this will be pre-symptomatic. We will be wanting to apply these therapies to people who are not yet sick. And that's something that also is a bit difficult to sell sometimes in medicine.
Well, but
so
you would
going to have to bite these bullets.
But you could almost go in for maintenance, right? So basically, it could get simplified in the future, theoretically, because people would go in periodically just for maintenance.
Well, it is maintenance. You're absolutely right. That's the correct term to use. But that doesn't make it simple. You know, when you take
well,
your car
simple,
in,
simple from the perspective of the person, but not simple from the perspective of the mechanic.
I think you have it exactly there. Yes, a mechanic needs to know a very great deal about how a car works in order to do all of the relevant aspects of preventative maintenance and get the car through its annual service. Whereas the patient, in the case of the car, the owner of the car, just needs to know who the mechanic is. So yes, it's going to be like that. And in terms of delivery, it's going to be similar too. So most of the things that are going to need to be done are stem cell therapies, gene therapies, stuff like that, which are predominantly delivered just by injections. And of course, the patient doesn't need to know how complicated the stuff is that's being injected.
We have to take a short station break. We'll be back in a moment. Hello, we are back with Business Game Changers on the Transformation Talk Radio Network and Conscious Business Radio, and we are continuing our interview now. Well, if getting back to telomeres, if your telomeres run out, even if you do all this stuff, will you die anyways?
Oh, yeah, you probably will. But why would your telomeres run out? I mean, this is the critical thing to understand. Most cells in the body either never divide, or they only divide very rarely when they're stimulated to do so by an injury, for example. And that means that their telomeres just don't get shorter throughout life, not measurably so, and certainly not pathogenically so. There are only a very small number of cell types in the body, the stem cells of a few rapidly regenerating tissues like the blood and also the immune system, that actually have any telomere problem in a currently normal lifespan. And they actually also don't really have a problem because they express telomerase, this enzyme that compensates for telomere shortening during cell division. So this is why it's actually really still a matter of significant scientific debate whether there's going to be any actual longevity benefit from extending telomeres.
Oh, interesting. So it's really a debate going on the edge of science right now on what path makes the most sense.
That's right.
Well, you know, Bill talks about the Harvard study with the mice where they were able to bring them back to adult, you know, young adult age by lengthening their telemeres.
Now, yeah, that was, hang on. So that was a terribly eye-catching study, but let's remember what the study actually did. Mice normally have huge, long telomeres, really huge, five times longer than ours. They never get any kind of telomere problem. The way that that particular study was done was to modify the mice genetically so that they didn't have any gene for the enzyme telomerase that would normally lengthen telomeres. And then those mice were completely fine unless and until they were inbred for multiple generations so that they were born with artificially short telomeres. That's the beginning of the study. And what the study showed in terms of rejuvenation was that if you artificially restored telomerase activity and thereby allowed the mice to grow their telomeres back again after they had been made artificially short, then, lo and behold, you got a restoration of health. Well, duh, what would you expect? But that says nothing about normal mice, let alone normal humans.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, it is pretty eye-catching, though.
That's what scientists have to do these days to get their grants funded. They have to be eye-catching. It's a bit of a shame because it distracts people and it slows science down in the long run.
Well, what are you connected with any pharmaceutical companies, or are you finding that it's important to be independent from that process?
We're not connected properly with any pharmaceutical companies yet. We want to be in due course. We certainly need to be completely independent of pharmaceutical companies in order to do some parts of our work, the parts that are really early stage and therefore not of significant interest to those people who want to make money out of things in the short term. But at the same time, as each of our projects progresses, it gets to a point where it does make sense from a profit-motivated perspective. And therefore, absolutely, at that stage, we want to partner with the private sector to make things happen. We've had a number of very encouraging tech transfer events happen over the last year. I mentioned already that our atherosclerosis work has recently been taken on by a startup company, and that's just one example. But there are certain things which are not really ready for that kind of prime time, and therefore it's essential that we are a non-profit, a 501c3 public charity, so that we can get tax-deductible donations to keep this work going.
Well, because as you develop different therapies, a company that sees an opportunity, they can take that therapy, they can go and market it and make good money off of it. And you want to be able, is your goal to license that and then use that money for your research?
Totally. Whether it's licensing, whether it's spinning out, whatever it is, we want to create a rejuvenation biotechnology industry, with the emphasis on the word industry. We know that a little nonprofit like ourselves is not going to solve this problem on our own. We want to be the engine room, the Kickstarter of all of this work.
Do you think that only the wealthy are going to be able to eventually afford this kind of process? Being honest.
There isn't the faintest chance of that happening. I understand why you're asking the question, because, of course, today we do have exactly that problem.
Well, just a normal medicine that's like that.
Well, especially high-tech medicine, because that is the most expensive. In the U.S. and even in countries like where I come from, the U.K., that have a public healthcare system, we do have the issue that expensive medicine is limited by its expense, and therefore it's limited by ability to pay. Now, the question is, why would the medicine that we're working on be any different? But I'm pleased to say that it's a very good answer to that question. The reason why today's medicine is the way it is in terms of reimbursement is because it doesn't work. It's because the medicine that we have today for the diseases and disabilities of old age only postpones the ill health of old age by a very modest amount, and then people get sick anyway and they die anyway. That means from an economic perspective, it's money down the drain. And the only reason it's spent is compassionate. But the medicine that we're working on will not be like that. The medicine that we're working on will keep people truly youthful indefinitely.
Well, and it'll also solve major diseases and problems. And so you're not going to be necessarily saying this is how you're going to stay youthful. We're going to solve your liver problem or your heart problem or your...
That's part of being youthful, is not having diseases of old age, right? So the point here is that these medicines will pay for themselves really quickly from the perspective of the nation, from the perspective of the government. So that means that I don't need to appeal to any kind of utopian humanitarian elixir. I don't need to think that the government will, quote, do the right thing, whether it's in a private healthcare dominated system like the US or a public healthcare dominated system like the UK. It doesn't matter. It's going to be so economically valuable to keep the people who were born a long time ago able-bodied and able not only not to consume the enormous healthcare costs that we see today, but also to contribute wealth to society, same as they were doing before. It's going to be so economically dramatic that it would be economically suicidal for any country, whatever their love or hate of taxes, not to front load investment to make sure that these therapies are available to everybody who's old enough to need them pretty much immediately as soon as they're available to anybody. That is the sheer mercenary economic argument, and there's no questioning it.
Well, what do you think about the overpopulation issue if we start to really get a grip on these things?
So again, this is another one that is absolutely overblown in an extraordinarily irrational way. At the moment, what we're seeing is a massive plummeting of fertility rates in all of the countries that are going through an economic transition to prosperity. It's not just China with its one-child policy. It's also India and Brazil and Indonesia and Bangladesh and Pakistan, all the biggest countries in the world, except Nigeria, but that's coming. They're all experiencing the most insane reduction in fertility rates. And, of course, women are having their children later on average as well, which also makes a difference. But the biggest thing of all, even bigger than those two things, is the impact of other technologies. What you've got to remember is that the so-called overpopulation problem is not a problem of having 7 billion people on the planet. It's a problem of having 7 billion people on the planet that are polluting the planet. And pollution is something that is reduced over time by technology. The most important example, of course, is climate change, which is caused by the consumption of fossil fuels. And as we get better and better at using solar energy, which I actually just got installed in my house last month, and for that matter, nuclear fusion and so on, we will dramatically reduce the use of fossil fuels, and therefore we will dramatically reduce the pollution that the average person causes, and conversely, we will increase the carrying capacity of the planet. So again, the idea that we actually have a threat of overpopulation, of uncontrollable overpopulation as a result of the elimination of age-related ill health, is complete nonsense.
But what about the food supply, being able to feed everybody?
Same deal. It's all about technology. We've been getting better over the past century, better and better at making more food per unit arable land, and we'll carry on getting better.
Okay, that's an interesting thing on it. I think that that will be constantly an issue that people talk about as resources.
And so it should be. You know, I'm not saying this is not an issue. I'm just saying it's not an insurmountable issue, not remotely insurmountable. Absolutely. The sooner we actually pay attention to the fact that this is coming and that we need to respond to the fact that it's coming by appropriate forward planning, the better. The more forward planning we do, the less turbulence there will be in the transition to a post-aging world. So I absolutely think we should talk about it, but the problem is that people talk about it in the wrong way.
They talk
about it as a reason not to cure Alzheimer's disease. At the same time, of course, as saying, oh dear, I don't want to get Alzheimer's disease. They don't think in terms of the fact that nobody wants it.
It's okay if you get it, but not me. Yeah, not a good way to look. But one thing that Bill said that I thought was really interesting is that the one problem he sees is that the people who have seniority will forever hold the jobs of importance.
Yeah, bullshit. Okay, completely.
Why?
Come on. How hard is it to change the tax regime so that there is a financial incentive to switch jobs every 15 years.
Well,
I mean, that's pretty bloody easy, really, isn't it?
Would
you really want to carry on getting Alzheimer's disease rather than make people change jobs?
No, I just think that what it would do is get people, if we evolve as a society overall, it'll get people working in the fields that they're the most skilled at or they have the most passion at. And no matter the age, those will rise. But that's not quite right. Well, it's not because people who are in power want to maintain that power. And I just don't know if a government incentive is ever going to – I don't know.
Yeah, come on. That's nonsense. The fact is we have democracy in most countries these days, at least most powerful countries. And democracy works by people getting reelected by the people. Now, that only happens if they want to get reelected. You know, they worked this out in ancient Rome. They worked it out in Greece. It's not exactly an insoluble problem.
Well, we'll see. We'll see when the problem happens. I suppose you can kind of theoretically think about these things, but there's always, as you actually implement things, there's always different problems that you don't foresee.
Of course there are. But look here. One's got to have a sense of proportion about this. If you don't want to get sick when you get old, then you've got to weigh the importance of not getting sick when you get old and of your loved ones not getting sick when they get old and so on against the perceived risk of these perceived hypothetical problems.
Well,
and you've got to ask yourself, which of them is actually more important?
We need to take a short station break and we'll be back with Business Game Changers on the Conscious Business Radio Network in a moment.
The doctor is in. Tune in to the hit show, The Psychic Love Doctor, with host Deborah Lee. Deborah's life-affirming, highly perceptive reading method has taught Deborah how to zero in on specific problems with relationships, career pursuits, and current roadblocks to success and happiness. Join Deborah Fridays at 2 p.m. Pacific and for a special broadcast the second Thursday of every month at 11 a.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
Are you feeling broken from your relationships? Are you second-guessing yourself about friends, family, and lovers? Tune in to the hit show that's creating a buzz in the love-seeking community. Love Seeker Radio, finding love for your authentic self with renowned love coach Heather Lynn. Tired of dissatisfying relationships? Kiss them goodbye and power up your love seeker energy. Coach Heather Lynn reminds you that you can just be you, the beautiful and perfect you. Visit heatherlynncoaching.com to learn more.
And we are back. This is Sarah Westall with Business Game Changers, and we're talking to Aubrey DeGray.
Well, my parents are in their mid-70s. What can they do to stay young and thriving and do their thing?
Well, I mean, depends how healthy they are. Some people in their mid-70s are biologically no older than most people in their 50s. But, of course, that's really the wrong question, because one shouldn't be just thinking about oneself. I'm not motivated mainly by the prospect of increasing my chances of never getting Alzheimer's disease by my work. The thing that gets me out of bed in the morning is the humanitarian imperative. The fact that every single day that I bring the defeat of aging forward, which I probably do at least once a month, I'm saving 100,000 lives, you know. That's quite motivating, really. And that's how everyone should be thinking. It's all about the humanitarian benefit.
Well, it's massive. But I also think that you could be saving the suffering, because so many elderly people are suffering in loneliness in old age. Because in our country, let's face it, we kind of push aside elderly. And it's kind of a shame, right? I mean, we are so young focused that...
You're totally right. And I believe it's all about the alleviation of suffering. Absolutely, the death is just one part of the suffering. But the thing is, one mustn't make too much of the difference between the kind of ageist rejection of the elderly and sidelining of the elderly that happens here versus the better integration of the elderly in society that happens in, for example, in many Asian cultures. Because even though they treat the elderly better, it only results in a small amount of increased healthy lifespan. The elderly still go downhill, and people don't talk about it very much. People don't think about it very much, but they still go downhill and they still die.
But do you think that the 4-year increase in age of living that Japan has is associated with the fact that they just treat their elderly so much better?
Of course, it's very hard to know quite which components of the difference between, let's say, the US and Japan make how much contribution. Very difficult thing to study. It's almost certainly a significant contribution from this cultural difference, and also from genetics, and also from diet. So many different things. But the fact is, they all add up to almost nothing. Only 4 years. I mean, I'm not saying 4 years is nothing. Of course, it's not quite nothing. It's better than nothing. But let's face it, it's still only 4 years.
Yeah. Interesting. So do you, so there's just nothing someone can do right now other than eat, you know, the basics, eat well, don't smoke,
don't get overweight, don't smoke. And if you've got a lot of money, give it to us. And if you don't have a lot of money, then you almost certainly know someone who has more money than you. So persuade them.
What about cutting on, you know, taking things that really, you know, that has all the antioxidants and stuff in it? People are talking about...
Yeah, complete waste of time. So let me explain why antioxidants are a complete waste of time. The fact is, antioxidants are all designed to soak up a particular type of chemical called a free radical, which the body makes as an intrinsic and absolutely unavoidable side effect of breathing, of the chemistry of breathing. So the question then is, what's the point of getting rid of free radicals? Well, ostensibly, it's a great idea because free radicals are very toxic. They damage our DNA. They make other types of damage. They definitely contribute to aging a lot. However, the thing is, evolution has had 2 billion years of having to make the best of a bad job since breathing was invented. And and it's done so. That's what evolution tends to do. It's rather creative. So it turns out that free radicals are actually not just toxic. They're also really essential components of the body. They are used as signaling molecules to make a lot of metabolism work. And that means that if I were able to wave a magic wand and get rid of all the free radicals in your body right now, you would die almost at once. So what happens if you take huge amounts of dietary antioxidants into the gut? What happens if they get into the bloodstream and the body immediately responds by dialing down its own inbuilt antioxidant machinery so as to compensate and get on and laugh in your face and get on with what it was doing anyway? Complete waste of time.
Well, how about the, you know, like Protandim or some of these medical supplements that bring your levels down to that of a young adult? They claim they can bring your levels down to a 20-year-old. Is that a waste of time too? Because all it does is, go ahead.
It depends levels of what. Levels of free radicals are not really any different in an older person and a younger person in the first place.
Antioxidant. Yeah, I suppose. That's what you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
But we're working on the part that can actually succeed. We're not working on getting rid of free radicals. We're working on getting rid of the damage that free radicals do before that damage accumulates to the point where it causes disease.
Well, so the free radicals are always going to be there. They're always going to be doing the damage. And so that's the stem cell therapy part where you just replace those cells.
And indeed all the other six types of damage that we're fixing. They're all types of damage that are caused by free radicals as well as by other things.
So you take your car in every so often and your car is your body and you get it repaired and you do the maintenance.
That's right.
And you go away.
And for the following year, you can carry on driving your car in the rain and allowing it to get a bit of rust, and it won't be problematic rust. The doors will not fall off because you will take it in a year later and get the rust removed.
Because the accumulation of rust hasn't gotten to a point where you're going to fall apart and the wheels are going to come off as you're driving.
Precisely. The car is built to tolerate a certain amount of that molecular and cellular damage. And the body is the same. The only difference, the only reason why we can't make the body last 10 times longer than it's designed to last, whereas we can make a vintage car last 100 years that was designed to last 10 years, is because the body is much more complicated and therefore the therapies are much more complicated. But we are on our way to getting there.
Very interesting. So if people are interested in helping to fund your research, is there anything that they can do?
Absolutely. They can go to our website, sense.org. I'm sure you'll put that on your website and everything. S for sugar, E for elephant, N for November, S for sugar.org. And there's a nice friendly orange donate button on the homepage. Go for it.
Can people also sign up to be part of your studies?
No, simply because we don't do clinical studies. We do not do any work on human beings. Any part of our work, once it gets to a point of being appropriate to test on humans, is already something that other people will be much more interested in, and they'll take it from us and throw much more money into it than we could possibly throw.
Because they can start making some serious money. Now, let's say somebody comes with a serious amount of money for you, and they can say, okay, I see that you're working on this particular deal, and if I fund you to figure this out, can I have exclusive right to market it? Do you do deals like that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, why not? I mean, any kind of licensing agreement has conditions of exclusivity and so on. So totally.
Okay. So you're open to negotiate and how you get your research funding.
Absolutely.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Aubrey. Thank you so much for joining us. And the only thing that I'm really bummed out at is there really isn't anything anybody can do. So right now.
You shouldn't be bummed out of that, because it's all about focus. You know, when people are over optimistic about what they can do already, that distracts them from what they need to do that will actually work, right? It means that people think it's a solved problem and they don't feel that research of the type that we do is even really particularly important or necessary. So that's why I need to be so downbeat and so pessimistic and realistic about what exists already or what does not exist already.
Well, and like you said, the question's still out there, how much telomeres, you know, what the role of telomeres are versus not with what Bill's doing.
Sure.
But, okay, well, good. Well, thank you so much. And I'll have all your information up on my radio page and on my website. And if you can send that to me, I'll make sure that it's there so people can know how to get to you and how to donate to your cause.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. It's great to great to be on your show.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview today. If you want more information on him or his company, please visit my website at sarahwestall.com. And you can also see all my past shows there, as well as full-length podcasts that you may have missed, because some of my shows are longer than what I'm able to air. But I also have a comment section, so be sure to put in some comments if you have something that you want to say about this show or another show. I know this one can be fairly controversial, as well as a lot of my other shows can be. You know, and whenever you're talking about things on the edge, disruption, it can be fairly controversial. But I've had a lot of spam hit my site, and I mean, literally, I've had just in the last week over 100,000 spam messages that have been removed from my comments. So if you put in a comment there and it doesn't come through, it might be the spamming thing, and so I need to look at that. So you can send me an email as well if you're having any issues with that. So for now, I hope everyone has an absolutely wonderful day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.